What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So, international segment at the moment, and we got a bit of a special one. This is an interview that I did with Ethan McCauley, who is a former BFM and...
BFM
BFM I'm not entirely sure, so I'm just going to go with BFM
yeah, cool.
I think I have a feeling he was on The Wire.
Well, do you know what?
And,
living in Thailand, he's kicking it.
Living in Thailand, in Bangkok, he's given us the lowdown on this sort of on-the-ground situation, even though he's like 10-hour drive away. But still, it's more
closer
on,
than us, isn't
more
it?
On the ground than here. So, yeah, it's let's kind of get into it, because I don't really need to give any background. Just do it.
Do it.
What's the background to this? How did it all happen? How did they get trapped?
So, 12 young people between the ages of 11 and 16 and their 25-year-old assistant football coach entered the cave at the time, right on the shoulder of when the cave, they have warnings saying do not enter because, you know, monsoon season here in the country does bring flash flooding. So they warn between July and October that the cave is unsafe to enter. It's fair to say, I mean, some people are saying that, well, they didn't go in July, but either way, you know, the risks were there. They entered the cave and did not return, which prompted the search and rescue and then recovery efforts. They entered on the 23rd of June, which makes this day 16 of being underground. They were caught by flash flooding in the area and had to retreat to a spot which is about a kilometre underground and almost 3 kilometres from the entrance to the cave, which is all of those conditions are what's causing it to be such both an impressive story of rescue but also quite such a difficult mission for the local and international divers have now assembled at the scene.
So is this cave complex that they're in, because I understand it's in quite a remote part of the country, but is it a tourist attraction? I mean, had you heard about this before this story?
The Tham Luang complex is fairly well known, but it's not the sort of thing that a lot of people would visit or pay much heed to if they are visiting the country as tourists, partly because, you know, this is the sort of thing where if you could compare it to, say, like a ski field, it's sort of like you've got, you know, the Happy Valley where you go and learn and you can take a photo of you wearing some skis, or you've got Triple Diamond, like downhill routes. This is a very difficult cave to explore. It's very well known in the area by the locals because it is, you know, a bit of an attraction even for the local people. But in terms of visitors, I know that there was a French expedition to survey it back in 1984. And at the time, you know, they were doing a big trip around Thailand and they were visiting various cave networks at the time. They deemed it to be a fairly complicated, fairly rough cave to explore. But it is well known both for its existence and for its difficulties. But no, I certainly had not heard of it prior to this, nor would I imagine I would encounter it at any point in my, even if I was up in Chiang Rai.
Chiang Rai is quite a far-flung part of the country. In terms of the infrastructure, with regard to the response team and regard to just the caves in general, I mean, what's it like? Are we talking quite basic, off-the-beaten-track, that sort of part of the country?
Yeah, you can certainly, looking into the story, you can see a lot of that. I mean, you're looking at, you know, foreign media huddled under a tent wearing their gumboots in wet clay soil at the base of the cave, but even, you know, the road in and out with the ambulances carrying the boys in and out of the complex. I mean, that's dirt roads as well. It is a very remote part of the country. It is very close to some of our border countries. So Myanmar's just there. And so as in a lot of our border areas in this country, we have very, very impoverished conditions for the people living there. A lot of the people living in these areas are undocumented or stateless people because they may recognize or may identify as some of the tribal populations which are not recognized by the Thai authorities. So you do have various layers of sort of deprivation in the areas as well, which is part of the reason why infrastructurally, yeah, the area does not necessarily match that of some of the some of the other parts of the country, unfortunately.
What has the response team been like so far? Has it been organised, or because I know that Thailand is one of those countries that just suffers under corruption just chronically. Has it been organised? Has it been coordinated, or has that kind of seeped into the efforts?
Certainly, yes. Thailand, you know, it would be silly to suggest that that's not a big aspect of things that happen, but in this instance, no. I mean, the main focus of this has been the fact there are 13 people trapped under the ground. 9 days after their disappearance, or rather 9 days after they entered the cave, they were found alive, seeking shelter on a shelf under the ground in this cave network. And the focus from the get-go, from the Thai authorities, from the very top right down to the bottom, the military, it's been a very coordinated effort, which has also involved specialist units from 12 different countries. This is not a case of, you know, somebody who doesn't have the authority or expertise sort of calling the shots. This really is the best of the best. I mean, we've heard various reports from some of the foreign dive teams who are involved that it's the sort of rescue that there are only a dozen or so people on the planet qualified to really, or experienced enough to really manage. So the coordinated effort has come from every corner of the globe, and, you know, everyone from frogmen crews within Asia, within the various militaries, to volunteer cave rescue operatives out of the UK. It's been a staggering response from around the world, all racing against time, just trying to ensure that these kids can get out and get reunited with their families.
What has the government's statement been on the matter? Have they made any statement, or have they kind of kept quiet? Or
I think the Thai government, and especially the local government in the area, the governor of Chiang Rai, it has to be said that they are playing the balance very well between keeping people updated and sort of stemming the tide of false reports and false information. I mean, throughout the past 16 days, you know, there have been daily press conferences with fairly limited information available, it has to be said, but the information that has been made available has been very factual, has been very devoid of sort of emotive information, but they have been very aware of the intense international scrutiny, but also of the fact that there are 13 families involved in this, and they're not, you know, nobody wants to be in that situation with us sitting out the front of a cave giving either false hope or bringing bad news when those sorts of things are underway. But when the boys were found alive in the cave 9 days after entering the cave, the government and the local authorities there were very quick to ensure that the right information was shared there, that all 13 members had been found alive and that recovery efforts and planning there was underway. Yesterday, in the early evening, around 7 p.m., the local and foreign media were asked to evacuate the area and were brought 4 kilometres from the site that they had been camped at for the previous 9 days at the entrance of the cave. So they were brought back 4 kilometres and given the information that they were being removed so as to not interfere or not be in the way of any particular movements of ambulances or rescue crews or whoever might be there, because the rescue was underway. The moment that we had the first two boys were removed and were rescued and removed from the cave complex alive, that was given as a report immediately that yes, two have been removed and are in good health. Two more were removed very shortly following that. Last night around 10 p.m. we got word that two more had been removed safely. And three of those boys were airlifted out, and the other was driven in an ambulance to the nearby Chiang Rai hospital around 60 kilometres away. So the information has been limited, but they have been very careful to make sure that the information has been accurate.
In terms of kind of the general feeling around the story, I mean, has this been a story that's kind of captured the imagination of the Thai public? Has there been a lot of response to this story? I mean, you said it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's remarkable in a way. One thing that it blows my mind in this country is how quickly the population will grab hold of one story, positive or negative. And I mean, all of the population of Thailand, and I mean, there is no one out there who I speak to on a day-to-day basis who doesn't know immediately what's being spoken about when they say, oh, the kids are coming out today. No one asks, you know, who are you referring to? Everybody's following this story. Everybody knows what's happening. And just a huge outpouring of support locally has now been mirrored internationally as the story has sort of grown more internationally, especially as some of these boys are being rescued. I mean, we're now getting various public figures and celebrities across the planet all sharing well wishes and all watching for updates of what's happening.
Finally, because this, I've been to Thailand, actually, funnily enough, been to Thailand in the wake of a disaster. I remember the Asian tsunami in 2004. My family took a holiday to Phuket. And what was amazing about there is just how the government so instantly responded to just rebuilding and getting business flowing there and getting tourism flowing there to make sure that people weren't scared away by what had come out in the news. Do you think that the Thai government and the Chiang Rai government will do the same with Chiang Rai province? Now there's been such a focus on that area. Do you think once it all settled down, they'll develop the caves, they'll close it down, they'll put efforts into actually attracting people to that part of the country again?
Look, I think if it had been a case of those cave complexes being, you know, the number one tourist destination in the region, then I think yes, possibly. But at the moment, the real questions around it remain that once it's all said and done, and once everybody's been hopefully recovered, and we do still watch with bated breath the hope that all 13 members come out alive and safe and are reunited with their families at the cave. Once all of that is said and done, there has to be a few questions asked around how this could be prevented from occurring again. There's a lot of conversation already, quiet conversation, because nobody wants to be the guy focusing on the wrong thing at a time of hope. But there's quite a bit of conversation around the various standards that do exist. I mean, ASEAN has spent quite a lot of time in previous years developing standards for tourism more in line with some of what the West might already have in place. And I think that this is just going to hopefully really accelerate efforts within the country to address, you know, safety concerns, especially around areas where visitors might be. And I think more than anything else, when this all comes out, you know, we don't know what the mental state of the children and their coach might be, but I would suggest that as a football team, if they do get back on the field, it's likely to be the most attended football match in the history of this country.
That is fairly amazing. It's an incredible story, and I'm honestly going to stop short of speculating on when they might come out, because I think that question's been asked a million times and no one has a clear answer, really.
Even the experts can't answer that one. The one that has kind of surprised me the most and has repeatedly been pressed by the international and the foreign media and journalists who are located here, they all want to know how the decision is made of who is rescued first. And I think let's just see if we can get 13 people out alive first.
Absolutely. So since then, there's been updates last night saying that officially 8 people have been rescued alive from the cave. There's still a few more to go. TVNZ's on the ground there. It's a whole load of foreign media. Elon Musk has also tried to insert himself into it by saying he can build a special submarine to get in there and rah de rah de rah de rah de rah. So everyone's kind of like, yeah. So anyway, that's what's going down. So hopefully the rest of the people who are trapped in there get rescued very soon.
Good luck to
he
them.
He wants to pimp his sub.
Yes.
What?
He wants to pimp his submarine.
Oh, yes. God. I don't even care about Elon Musk.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
This week on the Green Desk, Jack Marshall has a chat with Dr. S. Hollis Woodard, Assistant Professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of California, about new research into bumblebees.
Maybe just to start off, so we can hear more about like bumblebees, I was wondering what actually makes bumblebees different from any other bees? Because, you know, like to an outsider, bumblebees almost seem just like overweight bees without any honey.
All right, hold on now. Bumblebees are special for a lot of different reasons. I'll give you just a few. One of them is that they're social. So they have, you know, they live in a social colony where you have a queen and her daughters that are the workers. But they have an annual colony cycle where every spring you'll see these giant bumblebee queens flying around. And what they're doing is they're looking for a place to start a nest. And these queens have just overwintered. And queens at that stage, they are solitary. They have to do everything on their own. And once they start a colony and produce some eggs and they incubate them and then they develop and they emerge as adult workers in the colony. And it's only at that point that they are social. like a real, live in a real social, have a social life. So the queens, the fact that they go through the solitary stage and then become social, that's something that's actually really special, because honeybees don't do that. And most of the other social bees don't have that. So if you're someone like me, for example, who is interested in social evolution, you can study the sort of ontogeny of sociality in these bees. But then if you're interested in conservation, which is the work that we've recently published, is focused on this idea, then you really have to study not only when they're this big, you know, robust social colony, but also this sort of much more sensitive stage where you have a queen on her own, just trying to make it as a solitary insect so that she can get to the social colony stage. So that aspect of their biology is actually very unique, and that's one special thing. And then there are other things, like they can forage. They have these really cool thermoregulatory abilities. They can warm themselves and retain the heat, and because of that, they can live in places that are a lot colder, and like the high Arctic. And so that's another thing that's really special. So way up in the high Arctic, they're the only bees that you find are bumblebees.
So they are a bit special.
They are. Those are two. I could give you.
We could go on for
infinite.
Day.
Well, yeah.
We've got a little section later on bumblebee facts, so you might be able to bust some of those out.
But
So in your study, you've kind of found that pesticides and these really simple, I think you said monofloric diet, kind of have an overall negative effect on the bees.
Yeah, and these are two things that my work focuses on queens when they're trying to start a nest, but there's abundant evidence already from many other groups, many published studies showing that these two things on their own and in an interactive way are harmful for bumblebees. So people had already shown that that certain types of insecticides, that bumblebees are sensitive to them in all kinds of different ways, and that that sensitivity has consequences for their populations. And then the monofloral diet idea, too, had also been shown in bumblebees, that they need diversity in their diet. Even if they're only eating they eat pollen and nectar, even if those are the two things they eat, within the pollen diet, they actually need to be getting things from different types of plants. So they need that diversity, just like we need to eat different types of, you know, vegetables and fruits and stuff. So, but what was unique about our study is that we put those two things together, and we put them together in the context of queens when they're trying to start a nest, which we think is a really extremely sensitive time for bumblebees. So these stressors, when they're acting on a queen, when she's already presumably stressed, you know, she's trying to do a lot at that point. She's trying to start a nest. She's developing her ovaries. She's laying eggs. She's taking care of the nest. She's foraging. She's already doing a lot. And then if you put her under these additional stressors, it looks like can have devastating consequences for them.
And actually, just touching on that, when they're solitary and they're starting a nest by themselves, I was wondering, how do they start lay eggs if they're just by themselves? They're just a solo. Are they like a hermaphrodite kind of thing going on, or something like that?
Well, so they have bees are haplodiploid. This might be getting too complicated, but they can actually lay an egg, an unfertilized egg, and they can produce a male. But so queens and workers can do that. But these queens, when they're starting a nest, they actually mated with males the previous late summer or fall. And they store the sperm. And they store it through the winter. And then when they emerge and they can develop their ovaries, and then they can actually fertilize their eggs at that stage.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
Fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday, and always online at 95bfm.com. With thanks to Love Bucket, 309 K Road. Check it.
Stinky Jim. Things for Moving.
The Kaipara Community Association was formed recently as a form of protest against Tegel, the chickeny meaty company, their proposal to build the country's largest chicken farm on a floodplain site in Northland. John Walker is a member, so I spoke to him about the main grounds on which his association is opposing the build on.
Yeah, there's several aspects of it that just don't really add up. One of them is it's located on a known floodplain. There are stop banks along the edge of the river, basically to stop inundation of the land. And that does occur from time to time. And this is located right on those flood banks. In order to try to prevent flooding, they're actually building their own flood banks, berms around the sheds, in an attempt to stop the flooding. So basically, they're putting 32 massive chicken sheds on a known floodplain, which is, of course, a major issue. And that has to do with all the runoff from the sheds will basically just wash out through the existing drain system under these berms and into the river. There's the odour issue. A normal chicken shed would have a far greater odour impact, but they're claiming they have a system to reduce that odour by 51%. It's unproven in Northland, it's unproven in New Zealand, but they're reducing all of their odour outcomes by 51% due to this, which means they've only had to get written permission from five adjoining neighbours. Now, if that 51% is not correct, then there will be much more people affected, including two schools, a local church, a large community in Tekopru. So there's a lot more impact than they say there's going to be. They're burning 40 tonnes of excrement and sawdust a day. So, you know, that'll all be coming out of some 16-metre-high smokestacks and into the atmosphere, again, in the middle of this community. And it's just a massive, intensive farming situation. It's the largest in New Zealand. The previous largest, I think, has got 11 sheds. This has got 32. Each one of those sheds holds 40,000 chickens, which is 1.32 million chickens at any one time. And the total production is 9 million chickens a year. So we're talking a massive industrial complex located on a floodplain in a small rural community.
From the photos that I've seen, it looks kind of like quite a small space to hold such big buildings.
Yes, well, yeah, there's 32 of them. Each one is 138 metres by 20 metres. The pads alone are going to use 90,000 cubic metres of concrete. So it's very compact, it's very intensive, it's very extreme.
Sure. So environmental concerns really do seem to be the most prominent, and Tegel did release a report on the environmental effects with Tonkin and Taylor, and your association's website provides a link to it. So
yes. After
reading it, do you still think that despite the report there is evidence that the farm would be environmentally very unfriendly?
Yeah, so the Tonkin and Taylor thing is a paid-for pitch to the council. So it costs $4 million to produce that document, and they're trying to sell it. So, of course, they paint everything in the best possible light, and, of course, nothing will ever go wrong. And you have to take any kind of sales pitch with a grain of salt, and we've found, you know, several holes in it, and that's why we're fighting it at the council stage, and we will, if need be, take it further to the Environment Court.
So, for sure. Yes. They say that it will be a free-range chicken farm, but then they aren't even SPCA ticked.
No, they're not.
Are you guys looking into that at all? Or?
Yes, well, it is a concern to us and to the whole community, but unfortunately we can't. It's not one of the clauses they're breaching in the consent, so it's not something we can argue at the hearings.
Sure.
So it is a concern for us. It is effectively free range. They do have some outside areas they can go into, but apparently research says only approximately 10% of birds actually do that.
Mm.
And on the inside, 40,000 chickens in each one of these sheds, each one gets the size of an A4 piece of paper to inhabit. when they're fully grown.
That's wrong. That doesn't sound free range at all. And so Kapehu Marae nearby have also spoken out against the proposed farm, and their chair, Margaret Mutu, said that the farm would be just 350 metres away from their ura.
It is insanely close to the cemetery and to the marae.
Right.
And they will be massively affected there.
Sure.
They've got a quarry that is, the original proposal was the quarry was going to be 6 metres away from their back doorstep. They've since pushed that to 100 metres, but that's still not very far to be mining. I think they're going to take something like 40,000 cube of limestone out of there to build these berms. It's going to take 3 years to build this thing, and so they'll be mining and quarrying right next to the marae and the urapā for 3 years, and so it's basically going to interrupt everything they do there.
Will you and the marae community join together when you fight against them at council level?
We're supporting each other, but we're keeping ourselves separate with regards to the actual fight. So it's
sure.
like a two-pronged attack. But we're fully in support of everything they're doing.
Sure. And Tegel have hosted 6 hui, but they did not let RNZ attend one of them. And your colleague, Rosie Donovan, said this means Tegel is trying to control information. What's your response to this, you know, lack of transparency, really?
It's just crazy what they've done with the cultural impact assessment. Margaret offered to do it. They turned it down and got someone from Gisborne to do a cultural impact assessment, someone who does not know the area, does not know the people. One of the huis they held with very short notice was in Parnell, which is a long way from Kapehu Marae. And then, not only did they decide to host it there, but within the last 2 hours, they changed locations just to try to reduce the number of people to turn up. And then they would not let media in there. So they really tried to obfuscate that what they were saying that was consulting with the iwi. And in no way does that add up.
Mm. It's kind of up to iwi to say if that's consulting, isn't it?
Pretty much, and they're pretty adamant it's not.
Yeah.
They did try to host several other hui up here. They were turned down by several marae. One of the ones that they did hold had one person turn up. So that was basically a rebellion from the locals saying, we're not even going to come and listen to you.
So just to finish, do you have any final comments that you'd like to finish on?
Yeah, it's just a crazy situation to locate it. It's a crazy idea to farm that many chickens in an intensive environment. And it's dividing a community up here. It's just wrong for so many reasons. So,
sure.
We will keep fighting.
Good on you.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another Tuesday. Thanks to my producers, Connor and Sam. Also my friend Lachlan for always coming and hanging in the studio with me.
Also known as Big Hoss.
Big, yeah, sure, if he wants that. I like to call him Egg Hater.
I just like to call him Lachlan because it's his name.
Yeah, all right, Connor. Thank you to those who came on our show today. We had Tracy Barnett, Paul Kennedy, Ethan McCauley, Dr. S. Hollis Woodard. Cool title, isn't it?
What up?
And John Walker. Up next is The One to Four with Jin. We'll catch you next week. And I'm leaving you with one of my favourites, The Chicks, with Ready to Die.
Mm-hmm.